It's season two of the Carson McCullough Center's weekly We of Me. This is the first of two episodes based on our interview with novelist, essayist, and former McCullough Center writing fellow Melissa Pritchard-Schley. Melissa Pritchard-Schley is the author of 12 books, including a biography and an award-winning collection of essays. Her story collection, Spirit Seizures, won the Flannery O'Connor Award, the Carl Sandburg Award, the James Phelan Award, and was named a New York Times Editor's Choice and Notable Book of the Year, as well as a Penn Nelson Algren Award finalist. Other books have received the Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers Prize and the Janet Heidinger Kafka Prize. Three were named a New York Times Editor's Choice, a top title, and a Book of the Week by O, the Oprah Magazine. A five-time recipient of Pushcart and O. Henry Prizes, Melissa has published fiction in such literary journals as the Paris Review, Plowshares, Agni, and the Georgia Review. As the 2016 Marguerite and Lamar Smith Fellow at the Carson McCullough Center for Writers and Musicians, Melissa, now a Columbus resident, is in her second year as Image Journal's fiction editor, while at work on two novels and a fifth short story collection.
This segment of the interview has been edited for time and content.
You were the 11th annual Marguerite and Lamar Smith Fellow in Writing at the Carson McCullough Center. Just a little bit about that for our listeners. This residency fellowship, that is the Marguerite and Lamar Smith Fellowship for Writers, named in honor of Carson's parents, allows a single writer selected from a year's applicants to live and work in the Smith McCullough's house, Carson's childhood home here in Columbus, from September 1st to December 1st. It comes with a $5,000 stipend, and the recipient is asked to give an end-of-residency performance in November in which they read from their work on the campus of Columbus State University, an event that is free and open to the public. What made you want to apply for the fellowship?
What made me want to apply for the fellowship? Well, I had just, I was in the process of retiring from 25 years of teaching creative writing in the creative writing program at Arizona State University. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do next, except that I was going to write full time. And I was just, the university sends the faculty randomly a sort of list of opportunities, publishing opportunities, residency opportunities. And so it just came up on my email. There was a list, and on the list it said Carson McCullough's Fellowship. And of course I love Carson McCullough's work, and it was in Georgia, and the novel I was working on at the time was set in Georgia in the 19th century. And so I was like, well, this is serendipitous. So I clicked on it and I read all about it, and I thought, 3 months, that's a long time. That's a long time, but I could do it because I'm not teaching anymore. And it just fell, it kind of fell into my lap, and I filled the application, as I recall, wasn't, as some applications are, terribly intimidating. So I thought, well, I could do this. And so I applied, and honestly, I sent it off and I almost forgot about it, you know, until I got your letter.
Talk about your experience of being a Marguerite and Lamar Smith Writing Fellow. And staying at the Smith McCullough's house and working there. What was it like for you?
Well, how shall I start that? I drove across country with my daughter, my older daughter, who was also my research assistant for this Fanny Kemble novel. And I had my old geriatric dachshund in the car with us. And we drove and drove. And all I knew about Columbus was what I found on the internet, which was kind of odd. It was things about the Coca-Cola Museum, or the founder of Coca-Cola, and the military museum. And there was nothing that came up on the internet beyond the Carson McCullough's house that I was like, this looks like a very strange town. I don't know, but I'll be all right. It's just 3 months. If it's awful, it'll just be for 3 months. And then we got here, and I took my daughter to the airport along with my dog, because she was watching my dog. And I came back to the McCullough's house and walked inside. And I have to tell you, I was hit with the most peculiar sensation when I walked inside. There was a light in the rooms, a kind of light, kind of odor that just kind of stopped me in my tracks. It was I walked into the front sitting room, and beyond that is the second sitting room, and there are those pocket doors that open and shut that Carson used to give her theatrical performances, right? And her parents sat in the front. I just thought, this place is suffused with this kind of light, the color of old shellac or old dried glue or something. There was this amber kind of light that I perceived. And then there was this, an odor of kind of, there was this old semi-antique furniture sitting around. I hadn't yet looked at all the museum-like acquisitions about, you know, the personal items. It was a feeling, and it was layered. It was, I call it genius loci, spirit of place. Some places have it and many don't, but it's an accretion or an accrual of memory and time and persons who have been there, persons who may still be there in some form. Even the previous 10 fellows, maybe their lives there when they were all there, there was just a depth there in these rooms. And I just kind of stopped and went, wow. And so that was my very first impression.
Melissa, you are a special fellow in ways, but one of the most special is that you came to Columbus and never left.
I just went home to get my things and come back. And what's even more interesting to me anyway is my older daughter, the one who was my research assistant for Fannie Campbell and took a trip with me to St. Simon's Island. Anyway, she loved it so much. She moved here a year ago, and she lives in a little town called Mansfield outside of Atlanta. And she has a little horse farm there now, and she's living her horse farm dream. And I'm going tomorrow to go visit her. And and now we want my other daughter to come out too. We're all coming out here.
Ask the writers and artists I've interviewed from Columbus this question, because I think it's kind of amazing. No one knows who Augusta Jane Evans is anymore, but in the 19th century, everyone knew who she was.
Right.
So I've been asking writers and artists from this town what they think it is about Columbus, Georgia, birthplace and or home of Augusta Jane Evans, Carson McCullers, Nunnally Johnson, Ma Rainey, Blind Tob Wiggins, Tarleton and Darby, Amy Sherald, Alma Thomas, Bo Bartlett, and now Melissa Pritchard. What is it about this town that it should produce and nurture so much artistic and literary talent, do you think?
You know, I do spend some time thinking about that because, as I said, the first day I got here, I felt the friendliness, first of all, just a welcoming and not of artists, but of everybody. And then in the subsequent years, I've been here for 4.5 now, I have been so impressed by the community support of artists, the enthusiasm. The only other place I found that kind of enthusiasm was in Alaska, in a little town in Alaska. I think it was called Tok, T-O-K, Alaska, where everybody showed up for every artist that came through. Showed up, and there was just incredible support. But here, it's the same thing. There is this, there's a frisson, there's almost a chemical reaction between the respect for history that is here, where families, like you say, Phillips family goes back 7 generations, I think. And there are many other families here in Columbus like that. And the families are named, you know, the names go down through the generations. Mm-hmm. There's a preservation, and it's not it's a respect for the past, for history, at the same time while history is being constantly revised. So there's that ground layer almost. And then there's this spirit of entrepreneurship that I find, there's almost an efflorescence of the arts right now. I felt it when I first got here. And in the 4 years since, 4.5 years since, I feel it tremendously. There's so much going on in this community, in the arts. It's stunning, in music, in theater, in painting, in literature, for everything. You know, when I was teaching at ASU, we had trouble sometimes getting students to show up to listen to huge named writers. You know, we're like, somebody's coming to town, and 3 people would show up, and we'd have to work hard to get more. And here, the community shows up for everything. And he's enthusiastic, and there's just a sense of, there's also an interplay between the arts, you know, there's film coming in, there's a sense of, you are welcome here if you're creative. If you're a creative, do whatever you want, do what you can. And there's an embrace of that, of the entrepreneurial spirit, the creative spirit, embraced by the community. And that is just so exciting. And Columbus isn't perfect. Columbus has its problems like any other city. But I believe there is a sincere and deep impulse to redress injustices, to balance out diversity, to make, you know, to, there's just a spirit of the people here that I, it's deepened from, my impression is deepened, not lessened since I got here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of it. I really do. I walk around and I know I'm surrounded by history. I also know I'm surrounded by new things. Anybody I talk to is well-informed about things, and you can look in the paper or listen to the radio. There's something going on. Well, you started this podcast series not too long ago. And it's just, it's like, you have an idea, do it. One creative project feeds off another. So it creates a synergy, I think. Mm-hmm. I really think that's what it is. And mm-hmm. so the conservative elements of the community in terms of preservation of history, of architecture, of families, all of these conservative elements, preservation elements, combine magically with the new. That's what I feel. I think it suits my personality because I love history and I also love the avant-garde and the new. So to me, it's just like, where could be a more perfect place to create? I've been really impressed by the people who attend the symphonies and attend the theaters and attend, listen to the podcast. There's so much intelligence in this city. There's so many intelligent, sensitive people. Yeah. And people, okay, I have to say one more thing. People really dedicated to education and to the power of education and the arts to uplift a community and influence beyond a community. And you see that in the Carson McCullers Ma Rainey School of the Art.
Well, you know, it's absolutely true. I think it's true of this town that there are a lot of people, a lot of especially the older families of Columbus, who are really proud of their little town and mm-hmm. Have done a lot to promote the arts. And, you know, I'm sure you've been to many performances at the River Center, and including, I'm sure, performances at Legacy Hall. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have a lot of friends in the music school. And my friend Andrew Zone, classical guitar professor, he plays concerts all over the world. I mean, literally, he plays concerts all over the world. And I asked him one time, I said, what's the best hall you ever performed in? And he said, Legacy Hall. I said, no kidding. Come on. He goes, I'm serious. And he said, just the acoustics, everything about that is just fantastic. I said, so what, because he gets all the most famous guitarists in the world play Columbus because of Andrew, because he has the Guitar Symposium and other things. I said, what do they say, these people, like David Russell, who's a Grammy Award winner and stuff, when they come to Columbus and you take them into Legacy Hall? He said, they can't believe it. He said, they are stunned, you know, when they walk in that place. And, you know, he has this pair of guitarists, this duo from Italy, Solo Duo is their name, and he has them on contract to appear every year at the Guitar Symposium, and they have started doing their recording in Legacy Hall. So when they're going to do recording, they just wait till they get to Columbus, and because they want to do it there, because again, the acoustics are so good that's their chosen place of all the places that they travel around the world to do the recording. So anyway, that to me is shows you you know, how much the people of Columbus love their town, because they're the ones who paid for that and have done all these other, the Beau Bartlett Center, the Carson McCullers Center for Writers and Musicians is exactly that. That's why it exists. So yeah, you're right. I think it is a really interesting melding of the old and the new. There's the history of Columbus, all of which is not pretty, yeah. But there's a there, you know, in Columbus, Georgia, there is a there. And I think that everybody who comes here feels that. And I've had, you know, a lot of writers that I've had visiting poets and stuff are like, wow, this place is really something, isn't it?
That was my experience. I mean, I think the second day I was here, evening, I was invited to the symphony. And I remember my first, you know, when I got off the internet, it seemed like Columbus was kind of a little provincial place. It didn't look very exciting.
Yeah.
And I got dressed for the symphony. I just put on some jeans and a jean jacket. I was like, well, this is whatever Columbus is, you know. I mean, I really hadn't even been here 24 hours.
Yeah.
And I was just sort of had a really wrong impression of it. And we went to the symphony hall. I walked in. I was like, and everyone was dressed beautifully. And there's a gorgeous building. And I was like, oh my Lord, where am I? I'm not where am I thing again. And I quickly was, you know, disabused of my wrong notions of Columbus. Yes, there's a sophistication here along with and you're right, people invest in the arts here.
Yeah.
It's theirs. And then they share it. And there's you know, children are going to the theater school. They're going to the School of the Arts. There's Columbus High School itself has a long history of
Carson McCullers went to high school at which, by the way, our listeners should know that Columbus High School, which is the number one rated public high school in Georgia, it is an arts magnet high school now, and it's the high school that Carson McCullers graduated from in 1934, I believe it was, 33 maybe. And it's just two blocks from the Smith McCullers house. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's right by where Okoba Park, where you were talking about, that you used to go for walks.
And I wonder, I was thinking this morning, what do you think Carson McCullers would think if she could come back here today and see the state of the city of Columbus?
I think she would be pleased about a lot of things, a lot of change that has taken place. She wasn't happy about how slowly certain things were changing, for instance, with regard to race. And as Jen Chaplin and I were talking about when I interviewed her last week, you know, Carson was asked if she would donate her papers to the library, and she said yes if you integrate, and they said no, we're not doing it. And she said, okay, I'm not going to donate my papers then. And you know, Columbus has changed for the better in that regard. Not that we don't have a long way to go.
There is a long way to go, and there is in the whole country a long way to go.
Right.
We're at least doing it. At least we're starting.
I think that a lot of good things are happening here in that regard as well.
The dimensions of a work of art are seldom realized by the author until the work is accomplished. It is like a flowering dream. Ideas grow, budding silently, and there are a thousand illuminations coming day by day as the work progresses. A seed grows in writing as in nature. The seed of the idea is developed by both labor and the unconscious and the struggle that goes on between them. I understand only particles. I understand the characters, but the novel itself is not in focus. The focus comes at random moments which no one can understand, least of all the author. For me, they usually follow great effort. To me, these illuminations are the grace of labor. All of my work has happened this way. It is at once the hazard and the beauty that a writer has to depend on such illuminations. After months of confusion and labor, when the idea has flowered, the collusion is divine. It always comes from the subconscious and cannot be controlled. For a whole year, I worked on The Heart is a Lonely Hunter without understanding it at all. Each character was talking to a central character, but why, I didn't know. I'd almost decided that the book was no novel, that I should chop it up into short stories, but I could feel the mutilation in my body when I had that idea, and I was in despair. I had been working for 5 hours, and I went outside. Suddenly, as I walked across the road, it occurred to me that Harry Minowitz, the character all the other characters were talking to, was a different man, a deaf mute. And immediately, the name was changed to John Singer. The whole focus of the novel was fixed. And I was, for the first time, committed with my whole soul to The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. One cannot explain accusations of morbidity. A writer can only say he writes from the seed which flowers later in the subconscious. Nature is not abnormal. Only lifelessness is abnormal. Anything that pulses and moves and walks around the room, no matter what thing it is doing, is natural and human to a writer. The fact that John Singer in The Heart is a Lonely Hunter is a deaf and dumb man is a symbol. And the fact that Captain Pendleton, in Reflections in the Golden Eye, is homosexual is also a symbol of handicap and impotence. The deaf-mute singer is a symbol of infirmity, and he loves a person who is incapable of receiving his love. Symbols suggest the story and theme and incident, and they are so interwoven that one cannot understand consciously where the suggestion begins. I become the characters I write about. I'm so immersed in them that their motives are my own. When I write about a thief, I become one. When I write about Captain Pendleton, I become a homosexual man. When I write about a deaf mute, I become dumb during the time of the story. I become the characters I write about, and I bless the Latin poet Terence, who said, "Nothing human is alien to me." It is only with imagination and reality that you get to know the things a novel requires. Reality alone has never been that important to me. A teacher once said that one should write about one's own backyard, and by this I suppose she meant one should write about the things that one knows most intimately. But what is more intimate than one's own imagination? The imagination combines memory with insight, combines reality with the dream. People ask me why I don't go back to the South more often. But the South is a very emotional experience for me, fraught with all the memories of my childhood. When I go back South, I always get into arguments. So that a visit to Columbus in Georgia is a stirring up of love and antagonism. The locale of my books might always be Southern, and the South always my homeland. I love the voices of Negroes, like brown rivers. I feel that in the short trips when I do go to the South, in my own memory and in the newspaper articles, I still have my own reality. Many authors find it hard to write about new environments that they did not know in childhood. The voices reheard from childhood have a truer pitch, and the foliage, the trees of childhood, are remembered more exactly. When I work from within a different locale from the South, I have to wonder what time the flowers are in bloom. What flowers? I hardly let characters speak unless they are Southern. Wolfe wrote brilliantly of Brooklyn, but more brilliantly of the Southern cadence and ways of speech. This is particularly true of Southern writers because it's not only their speech and the foliage, but their entire culture, which makes it a homeland within a homeland. No matter what the politics, the degree or non-degree of liberalism in a Southern writer, he is still bound to this peculiar regionalism of language and voices and foliage and memory. The writer's work is predicted not only on his personality, but by the region in which he was born. I sometimes wonder if what they call the Gothic school of Southern writing, in which the grotesque is paralleled with the sublime, is not due largely to the cheapness of human life in the South. The Russians are like the Southerner writers in that respect. In my childhood, the South was almost a feudal society. But the South is complicated by the racial problem more severely than the Russian society. To many, a poor Southerner, the only pride that he has is the fact that he is white. And when one's self-pride is so pitiably debased, how can one learn to love? Above all, love is the main generator of all good writing. Love, passion, compassion are all welded together. In any communication, a thing says to one person quite a different thing from what it says to another, but writing, in essence, is communication, and communication is the only access to love. To love, to conscience, to nature, the God into the dream. For myself, the further I go into my own work and the more I read of those I love, the more aware I am of the dream and the logic of God, which indeed is a divine collusion.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Carson McCullers Center's weekly We of Me. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more at mccullerscenter.org or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. This podcast was brought to you by Columbus State University's Carson McCullers Center for Writers and Musicians and by Columbus State University's recording studio. The music you heard during the intro and outro was written by Lilia Uge in honor of Carson McCullers' 100th birthday on February 19th, 2017. I'm Nick Williams, technical director for these podcasts, and I hope you have a great day. Susie Parker DeVoe's reading from The Flowering Dream, Notes on Writing, is in the Library of America's The Collected Works of Carson McCullers. The music you heard during the readings was Le Fandango Verri by Dionisio Aguado, performed live in Legacy Hall by Hong Yin on October 20th, 2019.